That's my personal appreciation to all of you who have so faithfully attended these services week after week. It's been 8 weeks. I think we have had good attendance, and we have had young people who have come out Tuesday after Tuesday to study with us, and we appreciate everybody that has taken the time to come and study from the book of Hebrews. Now, we have tried to develop lessons that we thought would help all of us to live better, and lessons that would encourage us, and lessons, of course, that would warn us about apostasy. And this is what this book is about. It is about a people that were apostatizing, leaving Christianity and going back to Judaism. And he makes argument after argument, as we looked in the book in the beginning, to show the superiority of Christianity over Judaism. And then he uses many expressions in the book, "let us," we went through that, to exhort them to do better, that they might grow and that they might go on to perfection. And in our lesson tonight, we're going to deal with the admonitions that are found in the 13th chapter of the book. As he closes the book, he gives several admonitions, and I call these final admonitions to help Christians go on to perfection. And these are very, very necessary things in all of our lives if we are to be what God would have us be. And so as we start out in the 13th chapter, the first admonition that he gives, he says, "Let brotherly love continue." Now, brotherly love is very, very important. He says, "Let it continue." We are born to love. Excuse me. Go with me now to 1 Peter, the first chapter, and look at verse 22. And Peter says, "Seeing ye have purified your souls in obeying the truth through the Spirit unto the unfeigned love of the brethren, see that ye love one another with a pure heart fervently." So our love is to be unfeigned, it is to be pure, it is not to be a love that we're not to be hypocritical in the love that we have for one another. We are to have pure love, unfeigned love, and we need to understand that we are brothers and sisters in the Lord. And the thing that holds us together is love. It is the bond of perfectness. You remember the apostle said in Colossians 3 and down to about verse 14, he says, "And above all things put on charity," the King James, that is love, "which is the bond of perfectness." It is the bond that holds us together. And we need to understand that. And when we don't have love among us, then we don't have that bond that holds us together. And that's what's wrong with many congregations today. That's the reason you find the factions and the cliques and the things within congregations, the divisions, because brethren just don't have love one for another. They don't have this bond that is to cement them together. This is the thing that keeps us cemented together. And so this is the reason he would tell us to let brotherly love continue. Jesus would say, as we would go back to the book of John in the 13th chapter, verses 34 and 35, he says, "A new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another as I have loved you, that ye also love one another. By this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have love one to another. Now Jesus points out the badge of discipleship is the love that we have one for another. Now there are other things that identify us, but one thing that causes people to look and gets their attention when they see us is the love that we manifest to one another. And that's very, very evident to the world around about us. When we love one another, as a young preacher, I had this impressed upon my mind when I lived in Lebanon, Kentucky, back in the 50s, only one congregation in Marion County, still just one there. And at that time, the church was active and growing, and the brethren had great concern and love for one another. And I remember people in the world expressing to me the love that they saw and the concern that they saw this little band of disciples had for one another. And that's important. And if we don't love one another, the world sees that too. When we are at odds one with another. Now John talks about the love we are to have, and he admonishes us to love one another. In 1 John, the 4th chapter, he would say in the 7th verse, "Beloved, let us love one another, for God is of love, and everyone that loveth is born of God and knoweth God." So here he says, "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God," you see, "and everyone that loveth is born of God." And then he goes on to say, down in about the 11th and 12th verses, "Beloved, if God so loved us, we ought also to love one another." And he points out the love that God has for us. You think about the great love, the greatest love that you can ever know is the love that God has for you and for me. That love that caused him to give his son, the choice jewel of heaven, that you and I might be redeemed. And you think about sinners, worms of the dust. And God was willing to send his son to die for us because he loved us. And he manifests his love toward us in many, many ways. And he loved us and loves us. And therefore, he says we ought to love one another. In verse 12, he says, "No man has seen God at any time. If we love one another, God dwelleth in us, and his love is perfected in us." And then on down in verses 20 and 21, he says, "If a man say, I love God, and hateth his brother, he's a liar. For he that loveth not his brother whom he has seen, how can he love God whom he hath not seen?" So here he makes an argument. He says, if you say you love God and I say I love God and then I hate my brother, and he says, if I can't love my brother whom I have seen, how in the world can I love God whom I have not seen? So he says, and let's read it again, "If a man say I love God and hate his brother, he's a liar. For he that loveth not his brother whom he has seen, how can he love God whom he hath not seen?" And the answer is, we can't. If I hate my brethren, if I don't love my brethren, I most certainly do not love God. Verse 21 says, "And this commandment have we from him, that he who loveth God..." let me begin that over. "And this commandment we have from him, that he who loveth God loveth his brother also." And so we can see then that We are to love one another. Now this is agape love. This love seeks the very best for our brethren. You remember that Peter, as he writes, points out that we are to add love in, as we look at what we generally call the Christian graces in 1 Peter, the first chapter. He tells us, as we look there, in about the 7th verse of 2 Peter 1, he says, and to godliness, brotherly kindness, and to brotherly kindness, charity. And so here he uses two terms. He talks about brotherly kindness. This has to do with the affection we are to have. And then he says we are to add to brotherly kindness charity, or the idea here is love, agape. So we are to have affection one for the other, and we are to agape one another. We are to seek the best for each other. Now, as Paul writes to the Corinthians, he defines love in the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians, and I'd like to read Phillips on this in the 13th chapter, and looking on down, and Phillips, he just gives it in paragraphs. He doesn't give the verse number, and I don't remember right off what the number is, but I'm going to start where he begins to define love, about the 4th verse, I guess. He says, this love of which I speak is slow to lose patience. It looks for a way of being constructive. And that's exactly what love does. It is not permissive. It is neither anxious to impress, nor does it cherish inflated ideas of its own importance. And then he goes on to say, love has good manners and does not pursue selfish advantage. It is not touchy. It does not keep account of evil, nor gloat over the wickedness of other people. On the contrary, it is glad with all good. It is glad with all good men when truth prevails. And then he says, "Love knows no limit to its endurance." And so we then need to recognize these are the qualities of love. It does not go around losing its patience. It looks for ways of being constructive, and it does not cherish an inflated idea of its own importance. And these are the qualities, going back then to the King James Version, to about the 4th verse, when he says, charity suffereth long and is kind. Charity envieth not. Charity vaunteth not itself. Is not puffed up. Doth not behave itself unseemly. Seeketh not her own. Is not easily provoked. Thinketh no evil. Rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in truth. Beareth all things. Believeth all things. Hopeth all things. Endureth all things. Charity or love never faileth. And so here we see then that he defines love. And he tells us in the Galatian letter, if you turn to the 5th chapter of the Galatian letter, that love is the fruit of the Spirit, down to about verse 22 of Galatians 5. He says, but the fruit of the Spirit is love. Then he enumerates other things, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. But the idea is It is the fruit of the Spirit, the love we're to have for one another. Agape love is love that the Spirit teaches. And you and I must learn this love. We must learn to love one another. We must learn to put one another first. And we must learn to have the best interest of one another. And so going back to the text, he says, let brotherly love continue. Then he says in the second verse, be not forgetful to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. And this would go back to Abraham and Lot, when the angels came, the three angels came to Abraham, and then as the angels went on to Lot, and we see that Abraham invited them in, and he fed them, he entertained them, and Lot, of course, invited them into his house, and he entertained them. And so we are told then that we are to practice hospitality. That's what's under consideration. Peter would tell us in 1 Peter 4, and in verse 8, he says, use hospitality one to another without grudging. In other words, he is admonishing us not to begrudge what we do without grudging. We are to do this without complaint, to use hospitality. Paul said in Romans 12 and verse 13, he says, give unto hospitality. And in 1 Timothy 3 and verse, 1 Timothy 3 and down about verse 2, he points out in giving the qualifications of elders that elders are to be given to hospitality. And so, as we began to study the Bible, we see the Good Samaritan. We're familiar with that back in Luke 10. We see his hospitality to the man that was beat up on the road. And the priest and the Levite, they passed by. When he came along, then he bound up his wounds and carried him to an inn and paid his way. He showed hospitality. In the 16th chapter of the book of Luke, there's the rich man. He had every opportunity to show hospitality to Lazarus, the poor man that lay at his gates, but he did not, and he was lost. So we are to show hospitality to strangers, and many times we maybe fail to do that. When people come into our midst, people who are traveling through, and they may stop to worship with us, how many of us take the time to become involved with these people and invite these people to go home and eat with us? Show them the hospitality of our homes. As Christians, we are taught over and over to be a people given to hospitality. Jesus in the book of Luke, in the 14th chapter of the book of Luke, he says, beginning with the 12th verse, then said he also to him that bade him, when thou makest a dinner or a supper, call not thy friends, nor thy brethren, neither thy kinsmen, nor thy rich neighbors, lest they also bid thee again, and a recompense be made thee. But when thou makest a feast, call the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind, and thou shalt be blessed, for they cannot recompense thee. For thou shalt be recompensed at the resurrection of the just. And here Jesus points out that many times the people that we like to associate with and we like to feed and we like to have them around, and it's all right, but we like our friends and people that we're familiar with, and we recompense them and they recompense us. But here Jesus points out we ought to reach out to people who have need, who can't recompense. And then he says, when we truly reach out to people, we will be recompensed in the resurrection of the just. And so we need to show hospitality. We need to show hospitality to strangers. We need to show hospitality to men that come through who preach the gospel. We have men who come among us preaching the gospel, and when they are among us, then it is our responsibility to show hospitality to these men. They need a place to stay. They need a place to eat. They need to be taken care of when they are among us. And that's our responsibility. That's a responsibility that rests upon every Christian. But you see, sometimes we are just so afraid. Sometimes we are afraid of preachers. Some people are. I don't know why. They're afraid to have preachers in their home. And, you know, been my experience in life, most of us who preach come from poor families. There are not many fellows who preach who came from any rich family. Because if they come out of a family with money, they were going to inherit the family business or something. And most of the time they didn't go out preaching. There are a few exceptions. But most boys who preach, they have drank their coffee with a handle off, or they've seen a broken plate. They've seen dishes and things that didn't match and things of this nature. So we ought not to be afraid to invite the preacher. It wouldn't matter anyway. And if he made fun or didn't like what you, there'd be something wrong with him. That'd be the problem. And so we ought to show hospitality. And that is a duty. And this is what he admonishes us to do. Then in the third verse, he now talks about the sympathy we are to have for one another. He says, remember them that are in bonds as bound with them, and them which suffer adversity as being yourself also in the body. Now, you see, he talks about Christians now that were suffering, Christians who had been bound, they had been imprisoned, and so there is a responsibility of other Christians to suffer with them. He says, remember them that are in bonds as bound with them. In other words, sympathize, put yourself in their shoes, and them that suffer adversity as being yourselves also in the body. And so this is a responsibility that rests upon all of us, to sympathize. That's the idea of sympathy, is to put ourselves in the other fellow's shoes. Feel as he feels. Going back to the Roman letter, the apostle would tell us there in the 12th chapter of the Roman letter, and look down, if you will, to about verse 15. He says, rejoice with them that do rejoice, and weep with them that weep. Here he is pointing out again, we are to feel with our brethren. We're to be able to be of the same mind with them. Look on there in the 16th verse. He says, be of the same mind one to another. And here when he uses the same mind, we may pick up this verse sometime and and we may use it to talk about unity of the faith, and most certainly many verses teach that. But here I'm persuaded when he says be of the same mind one toward another, he's talking about in sympathy. We are to be able to feel with our brethren what they are feeling, the same thing that he's saying back here in Hebrews 13 and verse 3. If a fellow is in bonds, be able to put yourself in his shoes and feel as he feels. And so it is very, very important then that we sympathize with each other. In the 12th chapter of the 1st Corinthian letter, and in verse 26, he says, "And whether one member suffer, all members suffer with it, or one member be honored, all members rejoice with it." Here again, he shows how we are to feel for one another. Whenever you have a bad experience, what is my responsibility? I am to feel with you. You know, we've got sick in the congregation. Sister Dwyer is sick, and she fell, and Leah is sick, and others. And we need to feel with these people, sympathize with them, put ourselves in their shoes, try to understand from the standpoint of their sickness. Whenever a brother has adversity, setbacks, and problems, what's my responsibility? To try to kick him down, make him hurt more? No. My responsibility is to try to feel with him, get myself in his shoes, and see it from his vantage point. That's what Christianity is all about. Christianity is a very practical thing. Christianity is sensible and practical. Now, what helps us, our brethren, do when we are in trouble? Whenever our brethren come and they sympathize with us, and they feel with us, and they support us, oh, that's wonderful. But you see, where do we learn all this? From this book. This is not the way the world acts. Oh, there may be some of the world who's been influenced some by this book that acts this way, but they act entirely different. But this is the way Christians are to act. And when we don't act this way toward one another, we're not Christians. I don't care how much we say we're Christians. We're not Christians. We act very un-Christian. I must use the word in that way. That's the way we, many times. And sometimes, you know, some people hold on because they are Christians, because they don't stay faithful because of the way the brethren treat them. They stay faithful because they know what Christianity is all about, and they know in whom they have their faith, and they know who's going to reward them, and that's where all of us need to be. But we can make it a lot easier on one another if we would learn to sympathize with one another, to feel for one another, and to reach out to one another. And that's the way it must be. Love, sympathy. And then he goes on to say, in the fourth verse, he talks about the marriage relationship. He talks about keeping the marriage honorable. Christians must preserve the marriage bed undefiled, he says. In verse 4, he says, I'll have to get to the text. I turned away from it. He says, marriage is honorable in all, and the bed undefiled, but whoremongers and adulterers God will judge. Now, he points out that marriage is honorable in all. It is an honorable relationship. All that is involved in marriage is honorable. Paul would say in 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 2, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. And then he points out the responsibility that rests upon both husband and wife from the conjugal relationship. He says in verse 3, let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence, or her due affections. And this is a duty. This is due her. She has a right to this. And likewise also the wife unto the husband. He has a right to this. The wife hath not power of her own body, but the husband. And likewise also the husband hath not power of his own body, but the wife. And so he points out that in the marriage relationship, our bodies belong to one another. And we have a right in this relationship to have our desires fulfilled. It is a duty. And wherever people marry, they need to understand this responsibility. And then in verse 5, he points out that Christians must not defraud or deprive one another of this relationship unless it be with consent. Verse 5 says, defraud ye not one another, or don't deprive one another, I guess some of the translators would say, except it be with consent for a time, that ye may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency or lack of self-control. Excuse me. Now he warns all of us that if we live out of the marital relationship too long, there is a danger that we may be tempted. We may be tempted to do exactly what he condemns here. We may be tempted to enter into an adulterous relationship. Might be tempted to commit fornication. And so he points out that the way a husband and wife, they are to stay out of sin, to preserve this relationship, is for each one to recognize his responsibility in the relationship, to fulfill the other's needs and not defraud one another. Now, Christians are told to abstain from fornication, as Paul would write to the Thessalonians in the First Thessalonian letter in the fourth chapter and down about the third verse. He says, for this is the will of God, even your sanctification, that ye should abstain from fornication. Over and over, you see, as we read the epistles, the marriage relationship is dealt with, and we are warned over and over not to commit fornication, to abstain from fornication. He goes on to say in verse 4 in this text that every one of you should know how to possess his vessel, or his body would be the idea, in sanctification and honor. Well, how do I possess my body, and how do you possess yours in sanctification and honor? In the marriage relationship. Marriage is honorable in all. This is the only relationship God has ordained to fulfill the desires of the sexual desires. But when those desires are fulfilled in marriage, this is honorable. And then he warns there in verse 6. He says, that no man go beyond and defraud his brother in any matter. The matter under consideration, of course, is the matter of fornication. And defraud his brother in any matter, because the Lord is the avenger of all such, as we also have forewarned you and testified. Now, we are warned that for violating the marriage bed, the Lord is the avenger of this. And of course, that's what he goes on to say here in the Hebrew text, you see. He points out that marriage is honorable in all and the bed undefiled, but the whoremonger and adulterer, God will judge. He will avenge this sin. And we need to recognize the sinfulness of adultery, and that people who are involved in adulterous relationships will lose their soul. Today, there is an issue in the church over marriage and divorce and remarriage. And the problem is, people, of course, who have not properly, who have divorced and do not have the grounds, the scriptural grounds for divorce, are living in adultery. And these people are sinners, and God will judge them. And we most certainly cannot have these kind of people in our fellowship. And you go back, of course, we're not going to go into it, but Matthew 19, 3 through 9, and he points out in the ninth verse, the only grounds for one putting away his companion and marrying another is adultery. And so here he warns us and admonishes us to preserve the marriage bed undefiled. And indeed, we need that warning today. And then he tells us that we are to be without covetousness, as he goes on there in verse 5. He says, let your conversation or your manner of life be without covetousness, and be content with such things as you have, for he has said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee, so that we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper, and I will not fear what man shall do unto me. Now, let's look there at the fifth verse. He points out that we are to be free from covetousness. Our manner of life, you see, let your manner of life be free or be without covetousness. And the idea is our manner of life is to be free from the love of money. And this is what Paul warns about in 1 Timothy 6 and verses 9 and 10. When he writes to Timothy, and he says, but they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is the root of all evil, which while some coveted after, they have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. Now we're warned over and over not to love money. It's not wrong to have money. It is wrong to love money. And our problem is, many times, it is hard for us to have money and not love it. And people can love it and not have very much of it. And we need to understand that. We are warned not to be covetous. Many people have money. A lot of people have a lot of money and don't love it. And they properly use it. And that's what he tells us in this same sixth chapter. He points out that people who have money have a responsibility to use money, the money they have. Don't love it. If they love it and they're covetous, they're not going to use it. But he says in verse 17, charge them that are rich in this world that they be not high-minded nor trust in uncertain riches. That's always a danger. And men have to watch that when they make money and have a lot of money. But in the living God, he's the one we're to trust in, who giveth us richly all things to enjoy, that they do good, you see, that they be rich in good works, ready to distribute, willing to communicate, laying up in store for themselves a good foundation against the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life. Now, money is essential to carry the gospel to the world. And many men have the ability to make money and make a lot of money. And there, as we've said, there's nothing wrong with that. And if they have that ability to make money, though, they must understand the responsibility that goes with it. And the responsibility that goes with it is to support the gospel, to be sure that a proportion of that money is used to defray the expenses of the kingdom. Now, we have different abilities. A man has the ability to preach. As he goes forth to preach, he's very much dependent upon his brethren as they make money. And it is a sharing, it is a fellowship, and that's the way it's pictured in the Bible. A man, Paul, went and preached, and the church at Philippi had fellowship with him. Now, if you're able to make money, then as you give your money and have fellowship with men who have the ability to preach the gospel, and you what? You share in their work. And so the Lord wants us to recognize the responsibility that rests upon every Christian now to use his money, not to be covetous. And you see, that's one of the problems. Here the elders over and over admonish, and I teach, and it's a hard lesson to get over to people. It's a hard lesson to get over to people that our money that we make, a proportionate part of that is to be used in the service of God. God's people are not to be a covetous people, a people who love money. And there's a great responsibility resting upon all of us with our money, whether we have little or a lot of it, to defray the expenses of his kingdom. The most important thing in the world is to preach the gospel to the lost. And we're going to be held accountable to how we have used our ability along these lines. But then in the fifth verse, going back now to our text, he talks about contentment. And we are to be a contented people as the children of God. He says, let your conversation be without covetousness, and be content with such things as you have. Now, here he tells us to be content. Now, he's not saying it is wrong for you to work, to make more money, to expand your business, but when you have done the best you can, and what little you may have, or what how much you may have, learn to be content with it. If you've done all you can and you don't have any more, you know what your ability is, you know your limitations, learn to live with that. You see, that's what people have to learn to do. They have to learn to live with their situation. Godliness with contentment, the Apostle Paul said, is great gain. As he wrote to the young preacher, he tells him in verse 6, but godliness with contentment is great gain. That's one of the first things that men who preach have to learn. Every Christian has to learn it. But first and foremost, as he writes to this young man, he tells him, having food and raiment, let us be therewith content. But, and then, of course, he goes on to warn what the love of money will get him into, but we have to learn to be content. Paul said, as he wrote to the Philippians in the 4th chapter, that he had learned contentment in the 11th verse of the 4th chapter of the Philippian letter. He says, not that I speak in respect of want, he says, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. And so one of the great things that we must learn as Christians is to be content. And the thing that helps us be content is to recognize the Lord is going to take care of us. He's not going to forsake us. And that's what he goes on to say. For he has said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. And over, if you'd go to the Old Testament, you'd see where he gives this assurance. And I'll not read these, but I'll give you a passage or two in the Old Testament, like Deuteronomy 31 and 6, and Joshua 1, 5, and Psalms 118 and 6. Over and over, he gave assurance to Israel he wouldn't forsake them. And that's what he does to us today. He gives us assurance that he's not going to forsake us. And that's what Jesus talks about in Matthew, the 6th chapter. He is not going to forsake us. We may not have a lot of things we would like or want, but the Lord is going to take care of us. And that's what we need to understand. We need to be content. You know, the psalmist in Psalms 23 and verse 2, he says, he maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. What is he talking about here? Contentment, you see. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. Can you think of anything that's more soothing to the human soul and this world than just go out in the green pastures and the still waters? Have you ever just gone to the river and get away from everybody and everything and just look at the water and how tranquil it is, you see? Well, we understand that. That's the tranquility that comes, though, to us who are Christians. That's what he's talking about. He's talking about the contentment that comes to the child of God. We need to learn contentment. That's what's wrong with the society in which we live. It's not contented. People are not happy. Now, the same problem that's in the world is in the church. Brethren are not contented. They're not happy with anything. They're not happy with their spiritual relationship. They're not happy with the congregation they are a member of. They're just not happy. They're hunting something else. The problem is not without, brethren. The problem is within. And until you solve your problem within, you're going to be unhappy with everybody. When you find yourself unhappy in this congregation, you're unhappy with the elders, you're unhappy with me, you're unhappy with the brethren, look within. Have I learned contentment? Where is the problem? And if you want to go to heaven, solve the problem. And if you don't solve the problem, it won't solve your problem to go somewhere else. You take the problem wherever you go. And the problem will be there with you just as much as it is here or over there somewhere. Well, this is what Christianity is about. And I see people, And these are vital lessons. What he's admonishing here, this business of loving one another, this business of being content, learning contentment, This has to do with our relationship with God and our relationship with one another. And if we don't learn this, we haven't learned the very basics of what Christianity is all about. The very basics. Now, we may think we have reached the place where we're the most mature and we've really reached perfection with all of our discontentments. No, it just simply shows we have not grown at all. That's what it shows, brethren. And these are truths that I'm going to preach here and preach other places. These are the problems. These are the things. Because this is what it's all about. And this is what he's doing in this book, you see. All the way through this book, he really gets down to the nitty-gritty of what Christianity is about. Then he deals with our relationship to the elders and the elders' relationship to us, our duties to them and their duties to us. Now, when we talk about the eldership, we're talking about God's government. Now, let me emphasize that. I think that needs to be emphasized to people. We're talking about God's government, his government for his church. This is his arrangement. His people need guidance. His people need shepherds. And he has made an arrangement whereby his people can be guided here in the earth. In local congregations, in every local church, there are to be a plurality of men. And these men are rulers and elders and stewards, overseers. And this is what he's talking about. And he says there in verse 7, he says, "Remember them which have the rule over you, who have spoken unto you the word of God, whose faith follow, considering the end of their conversation." Now, he points out our responsibility to them. They are men who rule over us. They have spoken unto us the word of God. We are to follow their example as they direct us in the right ways. And down in verse 17, he says, "Obey them that have the rule over you, and submit yourselves." You see, this is a responsibility. There is an over and an under relationship. We could never have any harmony, never get anywhere without respecting government. You see. You know that out in society. You just can't do as you please. We have to respect authority. And if we don't respect authority, we have chaos. And in this spiritual relationship, in the local church, he has centered authority. He has given a relationship whereby brethren can work together harmoniously and be guided in the work and accomplish his work. And so we are to remember the rulers. We are to be obedient to them, submit. And then he points out, of course, their responsibility. They watch for your souls. They're watchmen. They are concerned for the salvation of every member that's under their oversight, because he points out they are going to give an account. They are going to give an account to God for the way they have discharged this awesome responsibility. And he says that they may do this now with joy and not with grief, for that's unprofitable for you. Now he warns the church. If you don't cooperate, you don't work in harmony with God's government, and you're rebellious, You have to be disciplined. I have to be disciplined. Then it is a grievous thing for these men who have to deal with us. And it's going to be unprofitable for us. We can't do as we please. I don't know. We just think sometimes, I think we can just do as we please. It doesn't matter to God how we act. It does matter. We must learn how to act. We must learn how to act in relationship to brethren. That's what the church is all about. It is a fellowship, a relationship one to another. And we have to know how to conduct ourselves properly in relationship one with another to accomplish the ends that God would have us to accomplish. Then, backing up to verse 9, I want to look at that hurriedly. He warns us about something else. He warns them and warns us. He says, be not carried away with divers and strange doctrines. Now, already in the first century, the church had false teachers that had arisen among them, the Judaizers, and men, of course, teaching Gnosticism and other philosophies. As we read the Bible, you remember the seven churches of Asia and the church at Pergamos. He talked about the doctrine of Balaam, and also he talked about the doctrine of the Nicolaitans there in Revelation 2 in verse 15, and back in verse 14 he talked about the doctrine of Balaam. And Paul in 1 Timothy 4:1 talks about the doctrine of the doctrines of demons. And Paul talks about the doctrines of men in Colossians 2:21. And Jesus talks about this in Matthew 15 and verse 9. Jesus talks about the doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees in Matthew 16:12. You can see there were many doctrines that were being taught in the first century. And the Judaizer, and this is what was happening here. They were trying to get these people to abandon Christianity, go back to Judaism. So he says, be not carried away with divers and strange doctrines, for it is a good thing that the heart be established with grace, not with meats which have not profited them that have been occupied therein. And of course he goes back, of course, to the law and the sacrifices and things of that nature. And our hearts, those that had obeyed the gospel, their hearts had been established by grace, by the gospel, you see. And so he warns them about divers and strange doctrines. Well, we have to be warned today. We have all kinds of divers and strange doctrines that arise among us. Just like I enumerated as you read your New Testament, all the strange doctrines that the Bible talks about before the close of the first century. Well, we ought not to read the Bible like a fiction book. We ought to recognize today we don't have the Nicolaitans, and... I knew I'd say that sometime. And the doctrine of Balaam and the doctrines of other things, but today we have Calvinism and institutionalism and things of that nature, you see. And so this is the reason then we need to be warned about these strange doctrines that come along. And then in the 16th verse of the chapter here, he talks about the responsibility we have to do good to others. He says, but to do good and to communicate, forget not, For with such sacrifices God is well pleased. Now here he talks about the responsibility that we have to minister to the necessity of the saints, to use our money from that standpoint. You know, back in the 6th chapter, in the 10th verse, he would say, "For God is not unrighteous to forget your work and labor of love, which ye have shown toward his name, in that ye have ministered to the saints and do minister." You see? And he points out that whenever we minister to the saints, whenever we help our brethren that are in need, this is good and well-pleasing in the sight of God. Go to 1 John 3, in verse 17 is what I really want. 1 John 3 and verse 17, when he says, "But whosoever hath this world's good, and seeth his brother have need, and shutteth up his bowels of compassion from him, how dwelleth the love of God in him?" And we could just enumerate the passages. You could go to 1 Timothy, the 5th chapter, and there he would talk about the responsibility we have in our own families. Like in the 4th verse of the 1 Timothy 5, he says, "But if any widow have children or nephews, let them learn first to show piety at home and to requite their parents, for that is good and acceptable before God." Going back again, you see, to the Hebrew letter, he says, when we do this, this is well-pleasing to God. It pleases God whenever his children minister to those that are less fortunate, when they help their brethren, when they take care of their own families. And you can see this when you go to the 25th chapter of the book of Matthew on the judgment day. And there you see the Lord talks about the responsibility that rests upon us and those that will be approved in his sight then. In Matthew 25:35, he says, "I was an hungered and ye gave me meat. I was thirsty and ye gave me drink. I was a stranger and ye took me in. Naked and ye clothed me. I was sick and ye visited me. I was in prison and ye came unto me." Then shall the righteous answer him, saying, "Lord, when saw we thee an hungered and fed thee, or thirsty and gave thee drink? When saw we thee a stranger and took thee in, or naked and clothed thee? Or when saw we thee sick or in prison and came unto thee?" And then in verse 40, "And the king shall answer and say unto them, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these my brethren, you have done it unto me." Showing we are to be a people who have sympathy and love and feeling and reaching out. You see the picture you get from all of this, this chapter, when you read this chapter, the feeling we are to have, the closeness that is to exist among the people of God. Now this is necessary. And whenever this is not a part of us, we are not what God would have us be. When there is not feeling and empathy and sympathy, when there is not concern, you see, when we can't feel with one another, we don't love one another, then we are not what God would have us be. And you can see this is what the Hebrews needed. And this is what we need today. We need this bad today to keep us together, to keep us doing what the will of the Lord is. We cannot properly function and accomplish what God wants accomplished without these kind of feelings. We can't come in here and mad at one another, and some won't speak to the others, and this and that, and and just looking down our nose at one another and things of this nature. We can't do this and then properly carry on worship and properly get involved and convert people and have enthusiasm. You know, all of this just would put a damper on everything. And we need to understand that if we want to grow.